Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Senate House Library. My name is Simon Bastow. I'm a senior research fellow at the LSE. I'm part of the LSE Public Policy Group team. I say team, it is a team, and today's conference has been put together, and the driving force behind it is Jane Tinkler, and many of you will know her, and the rest of the PPG team. We've had an amazing response, and we're very thankful and grateful for that. I think it's a big issue, and we're very pleased to have such a variety and such a mix of people here today. You may feel that there's a sort of sense of celebratory ambience in the air. This is the fact that this session marks really the end of what has been a three-year project that LSE PPG has been carrying out. It's been funded by HEFGE, for which we're particularly grateful. It's been a broad canvas of a project looking at the academic impacts of social science research across civil society, business sector, and government. And it's sort of drawing to an end this Christmas. We're looking to publish a couple of books next year. We, of course, have a very active and vibrant blog that's been running for many, many months now, and so that will continue. So although it's the end of our research project, as it were, it's I guess, the beginning of many debates around academic impact and impact in general. And so today's conference is a forward-looking one, which looks at the future of academic impact. We've got four sessions in this main area. The first one looks at economic impacts of academic research. The second one looks at digital era impacts and new paradigms of digital scholarship. Then we've got a lunch, and then we've got a couple of sessions afterwards. The third session looks at sort of where we go from here, next steps, and the fourth is really about open access and new types of publishing. So those are the four main sessions that we're running in here. As the day goes on, we're also doing breakout groups or great breakout sessions in four well-signposted rooms around the building, and those cover issues around writing REF case studies. There's 360 days to go, I think, until the deadline for REF. So there's still a little bit of time, but there's a lot of questions to be answered on that. So that's one session. We're also doing another session on academic blogging, using social media, and another session on, what was the fourth one? On podcasting. So please, if you haven't already signed up for those, go and speak to someone at reception. There's still room in those sessions for you if you'd like to. So a few housekeeping points before we start. The usual mobile phone rules apply. Please turn the sound off out of courtesy, obviously. We don't want you to turn your phones off completely because we're obviously interested in you tweeting your thoughts in real time, and they will appear on the screen over there. So if that's your thing, then please feel free to tweet away. Our hashtag is #LSEImpact, as you can see, and we also have a Wi-Fi password, which seems to be NutHat or NewThat or something like that. So NutHat. So feel free to log on and check your emails if you want. All presentations, I should say, will be made available on our Impact of Social Sciences blog pretty much as soon as the event's over, so you can download any interesting slides you might see. And finally, there's a free lunch. There's lots of Danish pastries out there to be consumed, and a drinks reception afterwards, so you're very welcome to stay on if you'd like to. I should also say there are laptops around, I think, in the main room across the hall. We're running a website survey for academics and users of social science to give us their thoughts about how impact works and how they rate their own disciplines in terms of impact. So if you've got a spare 5-10 minutes, please feel free to go and sit at a terminal and give us your thoughts. So that's the basic overview, I think. The first panel today is is on economic impacts of academic research. I keep saying social science research because I've been doing 3 years of social science academic impacts, but this is more about academic impacts as a whole. We've got three distinguished speakers. Professor Patrick Dunleavy of the LSE, he's the head of the public policy group and really he's been the lead on this social sciences impact project for the last 3 years, amongst many other things. We have Nicola Dandridge, who's chief executive of Universities UK, the membership organisation for UK universities. And finally, Professor Sir Adrian Smith, vice-chancellor of the University of London. They're going to speak in that order. I've just introduced them. They're going to speak for about 15 minutes each, with or without notes, I think, and then we'll throw it all out to the floor and you get your chance to probe them with some interesting questions. So that's about it. I'll hand straight over to Patrick.
Thanks very much. Well, thanks for coming, and I hope at some point I will get to my talk.
Excellent.
So what I'm going to talk about is rather narrower than the whole theme of today's first session. So I'm just going to talk about the economic impact of the social sciences. But I think it's an area that's very interesting for a wide range of people whose contribution, I think, outside of the physical sciences and the STEM subjects, the contribution of academic work to economic development has not been very well studied and hasn't been very well dimensioned, if you like. So I'm going to just look at social sciences, but some of what I say I think would follow through into the humanities and other areas. So firstly, I just wanted to indicate the kind of area that we count as social science. So we're including in this business studies and education and really, if you add it all up, I think there are 44 learned societies who are members of the Academy of Social Sciences. And I think that's a very broad total. If you look at universities across the UK, about one-third of all staff in universities are working in social science departments. And there are obviously many areas of overlap with the physical and STEM subjects, physical science and STEM subjects, and with the humanities. But it's the sort of blue square type things that we're looking at here. And the But at the same time, I think it's worth querying this kind of rather conventional way in which we think about the social sciences. The division between physical sciences and social sciences has been with us for a very long time now, since really the late 19th century. And the question that might be asked is whether it's really the most relevant way of compartmentalizing and thinking about what the social sciences are doing. And in particular, we're moving towards a view that since we live in a complete globe that is almost pervasively humanized, not exactly everywhere, but it's heavily human influenced. We're having tremendous problems through the extent to which we're now beginning to influence the whole climate of the Earth. We've got 7 billion people across the Earth. We're moving towards some form of global society. We know that we have major challenges ahead in terms of how the economy and governance and social development of the world is structured. So it might make sense to start thinking about the social sciences more in terms of a three-way split between what you might call human-dominated systems, not only social systems like cities and economies and so on, cultures, but also including under human-dominated system a great deal of health and medicine, a great deal of IT and engineering, and so on. And then we have human-influenced systems which spread out really across almost the whole of the world. It might be arguable if there's any part of the world now that is not human-influenced at some level, perhaps rather faintly, perhaps rather extensively. And then we have natural systems that are not yet human-influenced. Perhaps they're all out in outer space. Perhaps they're all down at the subatomic level. But that's an interesting way of thinking about how academic work is currently structured. And that's also a very interesting way of thinking about where social science is located. So its core is in human-dominated systems, but it's also extending incredibly fast into human influence systems. And it's connecting very strongly with health and IT particularly, but also with engineering and planning and so on. So that's the sort of perspective within which we're trying to address the economic impact of the social sciences. And this has been a tricky thing to do because we've had some very good estimates of the economic impact of universities produced by Universities UK quite regularly, but they've been very aggregated. They've never split up the assessment of the economic impact across discipline groups. And it's tricky too because in the social sciences, you know, the whole way in which innovation measures and metrics of impact are set up tends to be dominated by the kind of metal bashing, looking through microscopes paradigm of what it is that we're doing in terms of research. And that's very important, but it's not the whole of what innovation is going on. There's a lot of hidden innovation, and particularly there's a lot of underrating of social science innovation and knowledge because it doesn't lead directly to the kind of competitive advantage that will make a firm a profit compared with its rivals or that will help a government outperform necessarily its competitors. But we live in an advanced industrial society. More than 70% of our workforce are working in services. We really should be seeing a relatively important role of social sciences in advanced industrial economies, and especially in the modern era where we're having very rapid digital change, where products are becoming services and services are becoming products at a very fast rate and in very many different permutations and combinations. So that's really the setting within which we sought to estimate the economic significance of the social sciences. And the first way we did it is the very conventional way that has been done before, using input-output tables from the national accounts, and essentially replicating the methods that have been used by University UK for universities as a whole. So we focused on the social sciences within that. For various reasons, the measures of what's in the social sciences that we used here are a little bit limited, but these are the basic results. In terms of gross value added, social science departments are adding £2.7 billion a year. Their activities are also generating economic activity in other sectors of the economy. Along with many other professional services, the social sciences don't have a lot of import content. And so we get another £500 million of value added elsewhere in the economy. And then finally, we looked at what happens when social scientists go out and spend their money in the economy themselves, people working in social science departments, and that adds another £1.6 billion. So we get to a total gross value added for social science in the British economy of £4.8 billion. That's not huge, but it's not negligible either. And that sort of is a very useful addition to our knowledge that we didn't have before. I should say the work on this has all been undertaken for our project team by Cambridge Econometrics, and if anybody would like to query the econometrics, we've got Colin Thong from Cambridge Econometrics sitting in the audience to help us answer those queries. So that's the first take, but we wanted to look at not just the amount of spending going on in social science departments and inside universities, but also at the impact of the social sciences in the wider world. And that's a tricky thing to do. But the approach that we've adopted is one that says, well, the social sciences don't produce typically commodities or products that can be then taken away and used by anybody. They produce knowledge, but they produce knowledge in a way that needs to be rather carefully interpreted. And so what we sought to do was to think about how far other sectors of the economy employ social scientists with advanced qualifications and advanced occupations in order to mediate the research that social science produces. And we've used a range of approaches to try and estimate how that number should be calculated. We've particularly focused on the employment of highly trained postgrad staff in professional jobs, in particularly two areas where they are very prominently concentrated. One is in banking and finance, and the other is in the government sector. Now, we didn't quite get all of the government sector in because we're having a bit of a problem with the labour force survey on local government, but it does include central government, education, and healthcare. But in the education sector, we don't include teachers and researchers directly in this because we're looking at occupations that are mediating social science knowledge, not producing it. So there's some gaps. It's a limited measure, but this is what we came up with. Within government, we think that agencies and departments are spending somewhat over £6 billion directly on employing staff who are mediating social science research. We've added on a conventional 40% for on costs, and we've also looked at the extent to which government buys in economic and social science consultancy, which is, we estimate, around £500 million a year. And then we've also looked in the finance and banking sector, where we think the relevant staff comes to about £7 billion a year, and that's almost all directly in-house with additional on-costs. And then finally, in other business sectors, the concentration of social science graduates is considerably less, and the case for arguing that there's a need to mediate social science research is correspondingly less too. But we have come up with an overall estimate for economic and social science consultancy or related consultancy of £500 million a year. So let me wrap that up by saying that UK social sciences is a £2.7 billion a year industry with an additional gross value added of £2.1 billion if you allow for indirect and induced effects. In the finance sector, we can pretty conclusively say that around £9.8 billion a year is being spent on in-house staff who are mediating significant economic and social science research. And in the government sector, the same figure would be about £8.7 billion. Government and business sectors outside banking and finance additionally spend about £1 billion a year on economic and social science research. So you put that together and we conclude that the economic impact of the social sciences is at least £19.4 billion a year. So this is a significant important effect. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Simon, and good morning, everyone. And really pleased to be talking about the economic impact of academic research today because, as you'll know, it happens to be the day before the Chancellor's autumn statement tomorrow. And certainly at UUK, we're acutely aware of the context in which we are working at the moment in the midst of a very severe economic recession and facing an imminent a spending review, which is certainly preoccupying us at Universities UK, and I'm sure many colleagues, many of you, and some fundamental decisions are being made in terms of spending on higher education and research in particular. So a discussion about the economic impact of academic research is extremely pertinent and well-timed in that respect. You have a fantastically impressive lineup of speakers today, real experts on the impact of research. So I thought perhaps the most useful contribution I could make to the discussion today is to speak a little bit about UK's perspective on these issues. And there's three points that I want to look at, all probably rather pragmatic, but nonetheless, from our point of view, rather important. First of all, is why talking about the economic impact matters, particularly in the economic context that I've just outlined. Secondly, why at UUK we have been supporters of impact, not just in the REF, but in the context of research more widely as a concept and a metric for measuring the value of research. And thirdly, why we think impact is so important in a much broader context in terms of communicating with the public more widely about the value of not just research, but university activity. And finish with a plea, which picks up on some of the points Patrick was making, is why, conversely, research is so necessary for underpinning areas, particularly the social sciences, but even more particularly from our rather parochial point of view, but the value of universities too. But starting with the spending review, we know that the announcements that are likely to come tomorrow, but subsequently in any spending review decisions are going to be extremely tough. Growth at the moment in the UK is sluggish at best. And IFS analysis shows that even if there were to be no cuts at all to departmental expenditure limits, that would translate into a 20 billion cut to the welfare budget, which is extremely difficult to deliver politically, which is why many people are talking in rather generic terms about the possibility of 8% cuts across the piece. Now, in terms of BIS, we've already sustained very significant cuts, which translated into the transformation of the teaching budget. There's not a great deal left to cut there. So I think we are really focusing all our resources to make the case for the value of research in this very tight economic environment. And in the context of the last spending review decisions, it was very impressive, I think, in the circumstances that we managed to maintain cash terms maintenance of the science budget, albeit not capital. And I think in the context of what we're facing now, that does seem like a very positive outcome. But nonetheless, I think from our point of view, there is such a powerful case to be made for the public funding of research in terms of promoting and communicating the value to our politicians of research and decision makers as to why financial investment in this area is absolutely critical, and not despite the economic recession, but precisely because of it. Professor Eric Thomas, who is president of UUK at the moment, uses this image of a stagecoach stuck in the mud, the stagecoach being our economy, and he sees higher education and research in particular as one of the main horses that can pull the stagecoach out of the mud. Once he's advanced that sort of metaphor, it's very difficult to get it out of your head, actually, but it is how I see it, that we should be presenting research, the role of universities, very much as that enabling mechanism to get out of this situation rather than it being a drain on public resource. So from that perspective, we see the articulation of the value, the economic value of research as being really important. Now, that is absolutely not to say, of course, that research solely has an economic function. This is very well-rehearsed territory. I'm acutely aware of that. But I think it does flag the need to show that there is a very powerful economic function. We just heard about that in the context of the social sciences, and that is something we need to be prepared to articulate very loudly and very clearly. It's interesting in the context of some of the discussions that have taken place about what are universities for. I always find that a slightly frustrating question, because it seems to me that it should not be what a university is for, but what is it that they can do? And one of the things they can do is generate huge economic benefit. And I think the same argument can be applied to research. It's not to say that research equates to economic benefit, but one of the things it can do, and do so phenomenally successfully, is add economic value. And I think that's the point that we need to get over more coherently when we're engaging with politicians and decision makers, that really there is a very powerful case to be made here about economic impact of research, and just at the moment we really do need to make that point even more clearly. And I think it feels equally frustrating sometimes that the debate in this area has become very polarised between the extremities of blue skies versus applied, and that strikes us as utterly unhelpful. It's an impossible distinction to draw and ultimately rather futile, and also belittling to both sides of what is, in some senses, probably a spectrum. And certainly at UUK, we're acutely aware of the need never to promote one at the expense of the other, because they are so indistinguishable and also totally interdependent. These are extremely difficult issues, of course, and I'm just touching on them merely to pass on, but I'm very aware that these important discussions have to continue about what the appropriate metrics are and how we evaluate appropriately, how we can incentivize without distorting, and those are the sorts of discussions that undoubtedly will continue and must continue. But nonetheless, within all of that, it is important not to shy away from the fundamental question of the economic contribution that research can make. So my first point is that given we are in that economic environment that so much of research is publicly funded, we really do need to work together to make a coherent narrative about the economic value and the wider value that research makes to our society. And on that point, when one is discussing and negotiating with politicians and Treasury officials in particular, and my goodness, Adrian will be able to speak to this more authoritatively than I can, but certainly when we're there, one talks about the value of research for its own sake. A glazed look comes over their eyes. It really doesn't work. It has to be a much more purposive and impactful sort of argument as to why all of this matters so desperately much. And of course, the case is there. UK has, as Patrick's outlined, done quite a lot of work about the economic value of research. And we know, for instance, from Hefke figures and elsewhere, that the value of knowledge exchange alone rose from £3 billion in 2009-10 to £3.3 billion in 10-11. We are, when we're talking about the economic value of research, talking about billions, not millions, and the UK is updating its work in this area, absolutely at the aggregate level, but nonetheless, the case for the economic impact is overwhelming. And I think the point is this, that it's not a distortion to present the economic value, it is simply there in the research that's being done. And so what we are seeking to do is to articulate and present that case, and then that economic value can sit alongside the other impacts that research can have in terms of the wider social and cultural value. And this, of course, is one of the reasons, moving to my second point, why UUK has been so supportive of the impact agenda. It's not because we believe that research should serve a narrowly utilitarian function, nor that the value of research can be wholly reduced to economic value, but because the economic value is already there, and somehow in a rather sort of British way, it sometimes feels as if we're not wanting to talk about monetary value. And I think if we do that, then we do so at our peril and to our cost. And I don't think there's any room here for being purist about it. It is one of the fantastic impacts of research. And I think we certainly need to talk about it more openly and more frequently. But this is not, my third point, just a question of talking to politicians, the Treasury and decision makers. There's a very well-established case for the need to talk more openly and publicly and engage more publicly with the communities that we work amongst and live amongst in terms of the value of universities and research in particular. At UUK, we've done quite a lot of work looking at the public perception of universities, and I know many others have as well. And what our research so conclusively found is that for many people in the public minds, universities associated with undergraduate teaching, in part, I guess, a reflection of the experience of those individuals themselves, which is far more likely to have been one of having gone to university themselves and been very aware of the undergraduate environment, but much less exposed to the research environment, even at research-led institutions. But also, I guess, because they see their family going to university, and there's been so much profile around the tuition fee debate, that the equation does seem to be universities equals undergraduate tuition. And conversely, there seems to be a poor understanding, or certainly a less developed understanding, of the role of research and how the research activities that are carried out in, is carried out in universities benefits all of society, whether people have gone to university or not as undergraduates. And that has led to work that we've done at Universities UK with our Universities Week campaign and various other activities where we've been trying to engage the public in the wider value of universities and the value of research. And it is extremely hard work. Whenever we've had these sorts of campaigns that's talked about the value of research and we've talked to the media and tried to get the media engaged in it, it slips back so easily to undergraduate and tuition fees. That's what they really want to talk about. And I think we have quite an uphill battle here in terms of promoting the wider value of universities. And it's interesting to compare here the role of universities in the UK with perhaps that in the States, where there seems to be a much wider acceptance of the importance of universities and university research in the community. And that manifests itself in all manner of ways. At one level, I guess, in terms of the extent of philanthropy to research-based activities in the States, but also in terms of the wider community value that's given in the States to universities, which in some cases is not always the situation here. So I think there is a big role here in terms of communicating the value and indeed the economic value of research to society more broadly, and I don't think we've won that battle to any extent just at the moment. And it's, I think, important to reflect on this point in the context of the reforms to undergraduate teaching funding. We now have students and their families paying, although they don't have to pay, as you know, they only pay when they graduate and they earn over £21,000 and so on, but nonetheless the perception is they are in some sense paying up to £9,000 per annum for tuition fees. And the sense is that now students are paying for universities. If that is the perception, I think it's an interesting question as to where that leaves the public perception of public funding of research. And I think as we shift into a more demand-led system of undergraduate tuition, which does, as I said before, predominate public understanding of what universities do, I think there's some very serious questions to ask about the public acceptance of the need for public funding of research, which I think means that the sort of questions that we're discussing today are all the more pertinent and all the more relevant. My final point relates to the not just the economic value of research, to make the case for funding and wider acceptance of the value of research, but also the role of research in informing policy in this area. And this, again, a very well-rehearsed theme, but I'm struck again and again by the extent to which policy is developed, particularly in my area, I guess, higher education, by considerations which are far removed from those researched by the very many academics who specialise in this area in terms of their research. It's not always the case, and indeed this whole project is such a wonderful illustration of research informing public policy, but certainly from where I'm sitting, that is not always the case. And actually, as an illustration of that, now I come to think about it, I was reading over the last few days the Lord Andrew Adonis's book, Education, Education, Education. I don't know if any of you have seen it or looked at it. I think personally, I think he's a quite remarkable man who's left a quite remarkable legacy, and it is actually a really good book. Having said that, the bits I was reading, which is about the relationship between schools, universities, and social mobility, where he's advocating an argument for universities playing much more of a role in driving social mobility, he says that they don't do that at the moment. It's completely untrue and unfair. But he focuses on their role in terms of sponsoring academies and encouraging graduates to teach on Teach First programmes. End of story. And it seems to me we know that there is this huge wealth of social science and other research looking at the many and important ways that universities contribute to social mobility and the extent to which so many universities also put large amounts of funds into that area. And yet that's not feeding through into that particular decision maker's conclusions about the role of universities. It's just one example, but it's one that's on my mind at the moment. And this is not a criticism of universities. It's not a criticism of decision makers. It's certainly not a criticism of Lord Adonis. But it seems to me that we do have this situation where some of the research in this area is taking place in a totally different place to where the policy and decision makers are making their decisions. And I think this discussion about how we can promote the impact of research and the value of research is terribly important in informing precisely the sort of political decisions that are being made at the moment. This is hardly a new point, I'm well aware of that, but it's one I'm very acutely aware of, working both in higher education, where that research is being done, but also working with the decision makers in terms of what they want to do to higher education, that this is extraordinary, and in some cases, unfortunate mismatch between the research being done and the decisions being made. So, as I said before, this is happily not a criticism that you can level at this excellent piece of research, where it is looking precisely at the impact of the research that's carried out in the universities. And I very much look forward to reading the outcomes of it. It seems to be asking terribly important questions. It certainly will inform the UK's work in this area. And I think some of the debates and discussions you're having this afternoon about open access, the role of digital, and so on, are absolutely critical to this whole debate. So I'm really delighted and privileged to be contributing to the discussion and really look forward to seeing the outcomes of your debates and this critically important and very pertinent and timely discussion today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nicola. Sir Adrian.
I'm going to talk from a slightly different perspective arising from the fact that I come back into academia as Vice Chancellor of the University of London from the 1st of September, but I spent the previous 4 years in Whitehall, latterly as Director General for Knowledge and Innovation in BIS, and knowledge and innovation for these purposes covered the whole of policy and budgets for higher education and science and research. And what I want to do is really talk a bit about how it looks, from my perception, of how it looks and feels and the kinds of discussions and perceptions that take place in and around these issues in Whitehall. So I joined a department called DIAS, which was Innovation, Universities and Skills, if I remember correctly, back in 2008. And that was sort of tail end, beginning of the tail end of a Labour government with John Denham as Secretary of State, and Lord Sainsbury had just stepped down as Minister of Science, having, with Gordon Brown, produced a 10-year investment strategy for science and research, which had spending running a few percentage points ahead of inflation. Then there was a change of Prime Minister, and I had 1 year with Peter Mandelson, which was very interesting. Then we had the election and the coalition, and you know everything in recent years about the debates about higher education funding and science and research. So against that kind of background, without being indiscreet, I hope, just to talk about the kind of structures of thinking in Whitehall and where people are at, and I, of course I don't know where people will be at after an election in 2015, but I think there are some trends and some acceptances across the spectrum which may well be retained. So, crudely, looking at the research agenda, academic research, if you had to just do a couple of bullet points as to what the general perception in Whitehall and among politicians is, in the light of all the evidence and all the rhetoric and all the lobbying one brings to bear, the simple encapsulation would be that in the UK, we're fantastic at research, but much weaker at pulling research through into developments which either lead to wealth or to health or to other major social implications. So, fantastic at research, but the pull through of research, not just in a narrow economic sense, but into social capital or cultural capital, whatever, we're not so good at that. Now, you could debate whether that's true or not, and there's some simplistic assumptions that everybody else in the world, in particular in the States, are fantastic at this and we're not. And, of course, those issues are intimately bound up not just with academics and their attitude and the cultures within universities, but climates of financing, venture capital, all that kind of stuff. General environments of taxation, regulation, et cetera, et cetera. But whatever your analysis, the starting point for a lot of what's happened in recent years and the context in which one has had to try and argue for funding for research has been that. Great at research, not so great at what happens with it, to it. So back in the spending review in 2010, one of the ways that things work in Whitehall, there are kind of star chambers and the Treasury. The job in the Treasury is to be really smart-assed and have people in and try and destroy their arguments when they're telling you why you should give them money. And that applies no less to science and research in universities than anything else. So it was pretty vital last time round to assemble a very convincing evidence base. And it's just a reality, and Nicola's hinted at this already, it's a reality that you can't simply present the statistics of academic publications or citations or journal impact factors and hope to win the argument. In that Treasury context, against the background of recession and cuts, and remember there were many government departments being cut by 20-25%, how on earth to hold onto the money? There's an absolute need to get into that space that we now refer to as the impact agenda or the evidence basis of the impacts of research. And so as we're aware, last time around, we were relatively successful at that, getting flat cash for resource, and incidentally, getting the QR component of research wrapped up in a ring fence. So despite everything that's happened in the last few years, that total resource budget for research has been untouchable. You just have to go back to Parliament to unravel it. Going forward, that's equally important to get it ring-fenced. But there was, and this is not talked about so much, a substantial cut in capital. It was less of a cut in the research field than in many other areas of government, but it was about 40%. So one thing to note, if you're looking at the climate of how government feels about these kind of issues and how one needs to play the arguments and the logic and the rhetoric going forward, we have assembled evidence over the last few years that those cuts in capital would be damaging to our international position and that ministers couldn't just go around strutting that they'd protected resource in flat cash, because actually cuts to capital would be much more dangerous. So if you were watching closely, Every budget and every autumn statement since the last spending review, there have been reinjections, significant reinjections of capital into the research space, getting close to $1 billion since the spending review. So about two-thirds of the capital cut has been restored. Myself and those who've been there since September have put in front of the Chancellor, perhaps I shouldn't say this, a script that one hopes he will read out tomorrow, which would actually restore the rest. Whether that will happen, the statement tomorrow is of absolutely crucial importance. This is the key budget statement. I do not believe, despite what Nicola said, that I do not believe there will be a spending review before the next election. There may well be a circular that says between 5 and 8% cuts per department are going to be required. As things stand at the moment, that can't touch the science budget because it's ring-fenced. So we'll see if that holds up. But the statement tomorrow is absolutely crucial. And if it does restore further capital to research, then that will be fantastic. But perhaps least bad case is there won't be any touching of the budget. So one starting point, and I don't know if you were all aware, and if not, you might find it interesting to get onto the Royal Society website. Last week or week before, I can't remember, recently, the Chancellor gave a major talk at the Royal Society. And it was a talk which in rhetoric seemed to me game, set and match that the current regime has absolutely got the importance of scientific science and research in general and its pull-through as absolutely vital to whatever kind of future the UK is going to be. So my previous job, knowledge and innovation, the simple mantra that we kept hammering home is it is very difficult to see what kind of successful economic and social future the UK could have if it were not to do with knowledge, knowledge production, knowledge dissemination, knowledge exploitation. And if you buy that, then universities and the UK research community are at the heart of the future of the UK. I think that argument is pretty well won. The question then is, what does government do if it takes that as a starting point? What does it do about kind of structures and interventions? If research is so vital to our future, it must be very tempting for ministers to want to muck about with it and tell it where to go and what to do and how to develop the outputs. And that would be, I guess we all agree, fairly dangerous. So just reflect on what's happened in the last few years, or 5 years, let's say, in the space of structures, organisations, and headings around which these things have happened. So go back to the perception, good at research, not so good at pull-through. One of the major things that's happened is the creation of the Technology Strategy Board, which, if you like, is there to broker the interface between higher education and research and particularly industry. So I'll come back to that in a minute, but the creation of the TSB and the way that it brokers knowledge partnerships, knowledge networks, and more recently the catapults, and I'll come back to those, is a major ingredient in the landscape where government feels that we now have an agency which complements and works with research councils and universities to pull through the impact, particularly business industrial impact, from higher education. The other major thing that's happened within the research councils, and it was started in the spending review before last, was the so-called cross-cutting challenges. And I'll come back to those in a minute, but driving research in a slightly directed way, but actually with a very loose touch, towards societal challenges. So, for example, ageing. I'll talk about a list in a minute, because I think that will stay, and that will be one of the the bits of the framework, the structure, against which the impact discussions take place. So the creation of the TSB, a new agency in addition to the research councils, much more towards applications and impact, cross-cutting societal challenges, and then finally and more recently, huge debate in the context of recession and lack of growth about revisiting notions of industrial strategy as policy. And the words industrial strategy had kind of gone out of favor because it called up images of the 1970s where it was all about sort of picking winners and saving industries and saving the British car industry or whatever, whatever, and historically has been judged to be a total failure, that government does not know how to do such things, it does not know how to have an industrial strategy. But there's a slight air of desperation, you know, we're getting no growth, what are we going to do? There is a lively debate about industrial strategy. But what has happened, and this is relevant to the impact and the research agendas, is that whereas previously industrial strategies were about talking about sectors, so you talk about the car industry, you talk about the aircraft industry, you talk about the pharmaceutical industry, and then before you know where you are, if you're seeking to intervene in those areas, you are picking companies because there will be two or three big companies in those areas, and you'll think we can't possibly let company X or company Y go to the wall. What is really interesting, if you look very carefully at Osborne's speech and speeches of Vince Cable and others in recent months, is the rhetoric and the shaping of what one might mean intellectually and practically by an industrial strategy has now focused much more not on sectors, but on technologies as the drivers of the future. And I'll come back to that in a second. So TSB, cross-cutting challenges, identifying key technologies, technologies that are going to assumed to shape the world, where we in the UK have a competitive advantage in terms of our research capability and the capability to turn that into wealth or health or whatever. Against that other background, one final generic thing that a lot of the thinking around investment is where, if you've decided in what sort of area to invest, where and how do you get more bang for the buck? There is a pretty strong consensus, I would say, across political establishments, looking at evidence bases, Silicon Valley, Massachusetts, Corridor, et cetera, that concentration and clusters in many areas are the most appropriate way to go. And that has implications for universities in terms of concentration of QR funding. It has implications in doctoral training centers, all those kind of things. But there is a direction of travel that to maximize the impact from research investment in many areas, this does not apply to lone scholars in medieval German, in many areas where you've got big kit or big teams as the name of the game of how you compete internationally, then concentration and clusters are vital. There's a slide that appears in virtually every talk that's given in Whitehall about what do we mean, what are the dimensions of economic impact. We might just bear those in mind. One, improving performance of existing businesses, if we're talking on the narrowly economic. Creating new businesses, so things like spin-offs and the ability to fund and nurture spin-offs through to medium or large size enterprises. Another thing which is less obvious, and it goes back to the clustering issue, is that if you look at internationally mobile R&D investment, you know, where does BP put its research lab? Where does Microsoft locate? The dominant dimension is to do with markets, but once you get past markets, one of the key indicators is that strong universities, strong research base are a major element in attracting globally mobile R&D funding. So creating new businesses, supporting existing, bringing in external capital, and of course, above all, maybe, and Patrick hinted at this, the creation of human capital, of highly trained people, who just generically, the discipline may be fairly irrelevant, who form part of that attraction to overseas investment and also are the drivers of innovation. And then, not least, all that is rather narrowly economic and business industry focused, improving public policy and services. And that is certainly bought into. Remember, BIS, Business Innovation Skills, is just one ministry. The Treasury is just one other ministry. Out there, you've got environment, you've got health, you've got defence, you've got local government, culture, media and sports. In all those departments, the obsessions are not about narrow economic success. They're about social or health or environmental implications. And so that dimension is also crucially important. And the other thing that's happened in Whitehall in the last few years is that John Beddington, as government chief scientific advisor, has managed to get, in practically all government departments, a chief scientific advisor, and he has got a constitutional relationship of those chief scientific advisors, which means that all major policy decisions don't just get subjected to the usual Treasury economic scrutiny, but they also get scrutinised from physical science, social science, whatever point of view. One weakness in the current system in Whitehall is actually the absence of enough high-level, high-caliber social science government advisors. And I think there's an issue to be addressed there. So just briefly then, going back to those structures whereby government feels that we have got elements in place to address this major difficulty. Research, great. Pull-through, not so great. One aspect of that pull-through, TSB and catapults. So there are seven of these catapult centres which are getting investments of 10, 20, 30 million, which will act as centres of excellence for bringing together industry with research outputs. And just quickly running through those, they're high-value manufacturing, cell therapy, offshore renewable energy, satellite applications, connected digital economy, future cities, and transport. It's worth saying those words because in virtually all of those areas, even though it might, you know, it's got the Technology Strategy Board, it might sound techie, in virtually all of those areas and all of those interfaces, human behavioural, cultural and ethical issues are hugely significant. And so, going back to the social science dimension at the beginning, it's quite interesting in Whitehall that in all these discussions, I don't think in 4 years I ever heard a minister mention a discipline. There's absolutely no interest in Whitehall in whether you do geography, physics, whatever, whatever. It doesn't feature, it doesn't map. You know, if you take something like future cities, the integration of all sorts of technological and other systems, the social science element is dominant. But, you know, is it geographic? Is it economic? Is it psychological? You don't disintegrate these kind of things. So the headings in Whitehall under which impact is judged have got almost nothing to do with academic disciplines, which is quite interesting given the way that the REE and the REF work. So those are catapults. In the cross-cutting themes, again, from the point of view of what Patrick was saying, the social science elements are pretty dominant. The themes in the cross-cutting Research Council programmes at the moment, these are programmes that take about 15% of the Research Council budgets, and they typically have three or four or even seven of the research councils, plus government departments, plus industry. So living with environmental change in all its aspects, global uncertainty, both technological and other kinds of threats, aging, energy, digital economy, food security. You know, those in most countries and in the European Horizon 2020 planning, those are the kind of themes that crop up as areas where, if you're in government, you desperately need, you know, the best possible evidence bases to inform policy. But they're incredibly cross-cutting across physical sciences, across social sciences. And again, in terms of government looking into universities, they don't see disciplines. They see really cultural attitudes to contributing to those problems. And then finally, in the recent speech in November, Chancellor of the Royal Society, and I'm giving you the lists because these are the things that will shape the context in which impact going forward will be judged. The technologies that are seen for the UK to be fundamental in driving whatever kind of future industrial strategy we have. First one, big data and energy efficient computing, which, if you like, is everything to do with the information age. The incredible explosions of data that are out there and the challenges that poses in terms of handling that data and extracting useful stuff from it. The second one, synthetic biology. If you like, molecular biology is physics taking over biology. Synthetic biology is engineering taking over biology. So it's as if you've got an assembly line of little biological bits that you stick together to do whatever it is you want to do, eat sludge and turn it into petrol or whatever. Regenerative medicine, again, linking back almost to aging. If, you know, bits will require repairing if everybody's going to live to 95. And back on the agenda, after many years of really not being glamorous in research terms, are the agricultural sciences and technology, coming back to the food security issues, solving the genomics of wheat, for example, genetically modified crops, which are an absolute necessity for the future. We have to win those arguments and get that back. And energy storage. It's all very well inventing clever ways of capturing the wind or capturing the sun, which generates electricity, but you might not want to use it at that particular moment. So how do you store vast quantities of electricity which you're generating in the middle of the Sahara or in the middle of the North Sea? Advanced materials and nanotechnology. Robotics and autonomous systems. We are incredibly good in the UK at mathematics and algorithms. The kind of algorithms that are built into, up in Stevenage at Astrium, the design of the ExoMars Mars rover. It's a machine which has got to totally autonomously find its way around Mars, decide where to drill, and all that is driven by mathematical algorithms. And we in the UK are best in the world at that. And finally, things to do with satellites, the whole GMS and positioning stuff. So, to summarize, the context in Whitehall, I believe, gets that universities and research are important. It probably thinks there ought to be more concentration and more clustering. It desperately needs that research to turn into things, not in a crass, deterministic way. And even with the cross-cutting programs, which is 15% of the Research Council budgets, my own conjecture is that about 80% of what's funded under that is what you would call, if you cared about such things, blue skies research. So caring about aging doesn't mean you're removing academic freedom from researchers, because there are billions of researchers out there working on things to do with aging, fundamental neuroscience or whatever. So these applied fundamental divisions don't work. So the context, pull through from research, structures, TSB, headings which have nothing to do with academic disciplines, and that might be something interesting to reflect on, that that's not the way the world looks in Whitehall. I'll stop there.
Well, thank you, Sir Adrian, for that expansive talk. We're going to get some microphones roving around the room. Anyone going to help with that? So we've heard a lot there. We've heard, the academic perspective, how to think about impact, measure it in economic terms. We've heard the perspective from universities and how to sort of profile research, and communicate it as well. And finally, the sort of high politics view on, how these grand challenges are going to be met. How we're going to address this problem of pull through, getting research through, and expanding it and expand commercial and cultural and societal opportunities from it. So we've got about, well, the best part of half an hour for questions. Are there any microphones? Yes. Are there any questions, more to the point? No questions? One at the back there.
This is really for anyone to respond to. Nobody placed much emphasis on the whole SME and micro sector, and it seems to me that this might be a missing gap in that matrix that's being drawn up with RCUK and TSB in particular. And I'm not sure how aware colleagues are of TSB's active engagement in the whole enabling Horizon 2020 funding from here in terms of, you know, trying to get us together and do things. So I know there's a lot of activity within universities on SMEs and micros and good relationships, but maybe they're not fit for purpose at the moment in terms of where we're going. And I don't know whether colleagues would agree, but it would seem to me that that might be an area we might want to look at in terms of Universities UK and what's going on as actually a way of facilitating some movement in this direction and a development of a new culture. I'd just be interested in what colleagues think about that.
Could we take, say, two or three questions and give the panel a time to muse on that one? Anyone else with a question? Yes, down here at the front.
Thank you. I'm not an academic. I work in the public sector, and I have to say I agree with Professor Smith a lot of what he said. One observation I guess I'd like to make is that we actually find it really difficult to access social science. We find academia very cloistered and often unwilling to really work with us to provide us with the research outputs that we need to apply. How can we remedy this?
One more question? Yep.
Thank you. Just a question to Sir Adrian about where he finished off with the point about concentration and clustering. And I wonder whether you could say a bit more about whether you understand that in a geographical sense, because it seems to go against some of the direction of travel of research councils encouraging consortia and networks and sort of bringing people together from different institutional contexts, and also opening up the possibility of more engagement with wider communities than you'd get with sort of clustering in one place.
Okay, Sir Adrian, would you like to?
Okay, in the order of questions, the SME issue, and in particular Horizon 2020. The UK, the Horizon 2020 is the successor to the European framework programs. Historically, the UK has punched above its weight in framework programs from the university perspective, in that universities have got a bigger percent out than the UK government puts in, but industrially not. And part of the problem has been other countries, in particular Germany, have a very good brokering and support system for lining up SMEs to get into those kind of programs. The nearest we had in some areas of the UK were the regional development agencies. And the demise of the regional development agency means there's a gap. So this is clearly understood that there's a gap, and there is work going on to see if we get the TSB to be the brokering agent. But you're absolutely right to identify that. There's also some stuff in Tim Wilson's review of HE business interface, which is relevant to SMEs. The second one, the access to social science, maybe that's one for Nicola. That there's a lot going on in terms of arguments about open access to journals and in that space, that, you know, those kind of issues perhaps will be addressed. Finally, on the concentration and clustering, there are some areas where it is geographic, and the argument is partly kind of economic and sociological, that if you get a cluster, say, around Cambridge or in Silicon Valley, part of the rhetoric is that, you know, it's a, it's a low-risk environment to do high-risk things, in that if one little spin-off fails and you've moved there with your family to work there, there are 20 others in the vicinity, and so you haven't destroyed your life by moving house, and so you've got a community that feeds off itself. In other areas where you're trying to get collaborations and linkages because there's lack of critical mass, I think there are some areas in which it wouldn't be geographic. You'd take, it could be some of the cell therapy stuff. I mean, it could be somebody in Dundee and somebody in London. So I think it's horses for courses. But there's a certain kind of environment if you're looking for spin-offs and you're looking for PhDs and postdocs growing out of universities into those contexts, taking risks with their kind of personal lives, then that kind of concentration and critical mass provides a safer environment to do it than going off into a one-stop shop where if it fails, your life is screwed up.
Nicola, would you like to take those points?
Yes, just a couple of observations about some really good questions that aren't easy to answer. I think on the SME point, it's something which is being very actively discussed, and I think the point you've made and which Adrian has reiterated is that we're acutely aware that there is an issue here. And particularly, I'm thinking of in the context of the creative and cultural industries, which are such an important part of our economic regeneration, and which is entirely dependent on SMEs to take that forward, not entirely, but predominantly dependent on SMEs. So I think that is something which we are discussing, but I think it's fair to say we haven't been very public about it because it's not immediately obvious what the solution is, and it is a really difficult issue, but you're absolutely right to raise it, and perhaps we should be more vocal in terms of articulating some of the thoughts we're having in this area and what might emerge from it. In terms of access to, I should say on Horizon 2020, likewise, I mean, we've been very involved in all of that, and it's been a pretty, it's been some fairly fraught and problematic discussions, as you can well imagine, but the relevance of those points has not been lost on us and the others involved in that. In terms of the access to the social sciences, I think this is such an important question. I'm not quite sure it's something I can really add very much to, other than to say, I do think we've got to do more on this as a sector. There was a really interesting discussion that I was part of quite recently, which consisted of a bunch of academics dealing with knowledge exchange and technology transfer and some industrialists. And the exchange was precisely about the issue I've identified with the business leaders and industrialists saying, we can't access your research. And the university is effectively saying, look, it is there. You've just got to look harder and engage with us and talk to us. And then you'll see that the work is going on. And you've got to make clear your demands and expectations to us. And then we can respond. And that very much picks up on some of the Lambert conclusions about the problem is business pull rather than investors push and all that sort of stuff. But it was a really interesting discussion, and I remember something, Louis Just from Santander was there, and I remember something he said, which is rather struck in my mind, which is, look, if universities are not communicating to business the work that they're doing, then that is universities' problem, it's not our problem. And he saw it very much in those terms, and I have to say I rather agree with him. And that, it caused a few ripples in the meeting, because I think they felt it was a rather harsh judgment on our university's ability to communicate what we're doing. But I think probably it's right that part and parcel of the academic research has got to involve more effective communication so that we're making more explicit the wealth and richness of the research that's available. And in a way, I guess that's precisely what this discussion is all about, really. How can we use impact in a really positive way to communicate what's available more effectively? So I think it's a really good question, and I'm not quite sure that we've got the answer to it, but I guess the whole point about these sorts of discussions and these sorts of conferences is to articulate a better case and make sure that the platform is there for communicating it more effectively to those in the public and indeed private sector who need it. Adrian, you've answered clustering pretty effectively, so I'll pass on that one.
Well, the next panel obviously goes into digital era, digital scholarship issues, and that relates actually directly to the access question. But Patrick, do you want to say anything quickly on that?
Yes.
I think it's very disappointing that somebody can make that point from the floor in the way that you've made it about social sciences not being willing to communicate with you. Because, you know, actually, I think that is a very out-of-date picture, I hope. I hope it's a picture that's changing very, very rapidly because, you know, the diversity of social science communication has radically improved. There's a huge mass of social science disciplines now and social science scholars who have moved into a kind of completely different paradigm, which is a fast-acting, timely, very relevant, very accessible paradigm. And, you know, if you look on our blog, you can see some examples of that, you know, focusing on helping academics to be more accessible. But also if you look at, for example, the LSE blogs on British politics and policy, on European politics and policy, and our blog on social science book reviews, there's a huge amount of effort now in communicating and making accessible, not just to people outside social sciences, but also within the social science disciplines. So I'm sorry that it hasn't reached you yet, but I would imagine that it would do. And I do think one of the very good things about the REF process is the new impact element of REF, which accounts for about 20% of university funding, should provide a basis for more stable, more applied, more long-run, more cooperative relationships to develop, particularly between social science departments and the public sector and civil society and, to some extent, with businesses. On businesses, the point about the the micro companies and the SMEs, I think, is a really huge point. And one of the things that worries me always when I listen to anybody from government, and Sir Adrian has recently been in government, is that they have a kind of very big company kind of view of technology and a big company view of how change happens. And I just don't think that the list of things that was covered really addresses what I would see as being the happening things that are going to revive the British economy. So the British economy at the moment is being revived by things like the high-tech hub in the city. It's being revived by people like Victor Henning and Mendeley, who will be on in the next panel. It's not being revived by, you know, huge masses of funding going into big science projects and huge infrastructure investments. And I slightly worry that, you know, this kind of spotting technologies and going for, you know, big physical science technologies ignores the importance of consumers and democratizing innovation. I mean, innovation happens from people. It doesn't really happen from technologies. And, you know, although Adrian says they're all discipline blind in government, I think they're discipline blind in government because they're overwhelmingly, you know, physical science orientated still. So I think there's a lot of work still to do on pluralizing the culture and pluralizing the ways in which funding takes place. And a very small shift of resources from physical sciences to social sciences, I think, could produce tremendous economic positive effects and also lead to much more effective pull-through. The problems of pull-through are not technological, they're not scientific. They're overwhelmingly organizational and cultural, and they need social science kind of help to do that.
Okay. Three more questions. Got time? Microphone? Sierra, yeah.
Hi. There's been quite a lot of mention of pull-through, and I was just wondering how the panel thinks that works in relation to cultural organisations, and particularly at a time when a lot of their budgets are being cut, and it's obviously a very important part of what the wider impact is impact on museums and galleries and that sort of aspect of which make a part of the economy, and how that sort of pull through can happen effectively in institutions that are very tight on resources.
Any more?
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Caroline, I'm from the Royal Society. I just wanted to thank Adrian for his mention of the speech coverage, which is on our main page of our website if anyone wants to see it. I just wondered, as you were talking about the capital expenditure, which is going to be topped up hopefully in the statement, autumn statement tomorrow, Can you foresee over the next couple of years, if it has reached up to the levels it was before, that it will continue to rise, or whether it will, there will be no more announcements after the statement tomorrow, and what we could do to potentially increase the capital budget from the government? Thank you.
One more question. Yes.
Actually, a very brief comment to say that I think that disappointment with the failure of communication of social science is probably not enough, and that we need to resource knowledge mobilisation as an activity, as a function, not just expect academics for it to somehow happen between academia and business or the public sector, that we actually need to properly resource it.
Okay, we'll take one more, just because we're quite close to the end. Anyone else? Yes. Is there a microphone? Thank you.
Hi, my name's Alan Palmer from the British Academy. One of the things we do is convene the UK Strategic Forum on the Social Sciences, and a big concern recently of the organisations represented there, some of the big research providers, Nuffield Foundation, Leverhulme Trust, ESRC, and so on, is not so much the idea of creating pull-through infrastructure, but the availability of public sector and publicly funded and publicly collected information that's still trapped behind a number of different obstacles and barriers, in their view, largely created by a misunderstanding of various legal frameworks and data protection areas by civil servants. The view is the release of that information could drive a lot of innovation, and there's a lot of barriers at the moment. So be interested to hear from Sir Adrian if he's got any insights into where that might be going, given that he's still relatively fresh from the department.
Okay, Sir Adrian, once again.
In terms of cultural pull-through, all I can say is that at the last spending review, those arguing the case for British Library, British Museum and so on did not do a good job, full stop. Future of capital funding, I honestly don't know, but partly retaliation to Patrick. One of the recent capital things has been the Partnership Fund, where the rules of the game were for universities that if they could demonstrate that they could lever at least 2-to-1 capital investment from private sector, then there was money available. And there was only 100 million on the table first time round, but there was potentially 1.8 billion of private capital chasing that leverage, and so Conservative Party conference, another 200 was put into that. And I think it's too simplistic to be against big capital and big infrastructure. One of the problems at the moment in terms of economic structuring is people hoarding cash and not spending it and getting it out there. And this is one way of levering that kind of capital investment. So I wouldn't be surprised to see more in that space, but I have the faintest idea what will happen tomorrow and I have the faintest idea what will happen after 2015. Communication, I think that perhaps it was a bit missing in the earlier conversation, and that's to do with data. It may be that one has access to the views of LSE academics on what's happening in politics and the economy, but access to big data sets, which are major outcomes of major investments in research, are those easily accessible and usable? And one of the thinking in government at the moment, going back to one of those themes of big data, things like the Data Strategy Board, to oversee where public money has gone into producing data. It's somewhat ideological, and you might want to debate it. Current government view is that should be out there because it'll form the basis of lots of new businesses. So if Met Office data is freely available, somebody will come up with an app for pea farmers in Lincolnshire or whatever. And this is small SME stuff, and it will generate lots of business. So there's a major agenda in and around data and access to data, and data as a driver of business growth, particularly in SMEs. And there is a real issue as to whether we've got the right processes for access to data. There's a major task force, which, if it hasn't reported, is about to any second, chaired by Paul Boyle, chief of exec of ESRC, or maybe it's chaired by Alan Langlands, on use of administrative data. There are fantastic amounts of data that are routinely collected in government departments or for administrative purposes. How do we get those out there? And, of course, there are major issues of linkage and anonymization. But that, I think, will be one of the big developments in the next couple of years.
Patrick, would you like to weigh in?
Yes. So on big data, I think, obviously, there's a huge potential, but it's very important that it should be, you know, developed in a particular kind of way. I think what's been happening is a kind of rather crass kind of let's create huge data piles, put them out in utterly, you know, unstructured ways, and wait for an army of citizen entrepreneurs or citizen auditors to take advantage of them. And actually, it's a fairly skilled thing to intermediate between big data and creating usable information that actually people can deploy. And so I'd like to see a lot more work by universities as you know, intermediaries and bridges between the data piles and the citizens. And particularly in the public sector, the woeful lack of transparency, particularly made worse by the growth of outsourcing and commercial confidentiality, these are really, really huge problems. And the evidence is, for example, that we've lost hundreds of millions of pounds through having very weak transparency in many different areas, both in public procurement and, for example, in the area of taxation and tax declarations. You know, we're losing billions every year because we're letting companies that might be constrained if we made the information transparent export funds somewhere else. So I think, you know, improvements here are very, very important for public policy and can contribute very materially to improving the resources that are available to government to do things. Moving on to cultural organisations, it's a strange thing that cultural organisations, you know, are much more important for many sectors of the economy than you might think. They're very important for scientific research. There's lots of evidence that cities that are, you know, cultural centres attract scientific research, particularly in the USA. We haven't had the same amount of work done here, but there's a huge amount of likely influence of cultural institutions on the way in which communities develop and the way in which people move to communities and why they want to be in particular areas and not in other areas. So I think there's a huge amount more to be done, and we are getting to much better methods for assessing the economic impacts of many things, you know, the economic impacts of unspoiled countryside, the economic impacts of wilderness, the economic impacts of cultural organisations. All of those things, I think, there's a huge amount of progress being made on getting to a much more transparent, a much better understanding of how society really works.
Nicola.
I think Adrian and Patrick have really covered the points. Can I just add one further observation onto the discussion about the role of big data, well, any data, and transparency and communication and open access, that just for information, we had the government confirm yesterday that it finally, after about a year or more of lobbying and campaigning by UK and many colleagues in the sector, that they agreed that there should be an exemption for unpublished research from the FOI principles. And one of the reasons that we were so relieved about that, I mean, it's yet to be worked through in terms of how it will actually play out in terms of legislation, but it will probably model in some senses but go further than the Scottish equivalent, is that it's one thing to have all this focus on open access and transparency of data, but if you can't protect unpublished research, which is still in developmental stage and may be commercially sensitive, from the reaches of FOI, then it's going to have a very chilling effect on research. So that was the reason why we were extremely worried about it. But anyway, we've got the assurance from government they are going to move on this. And I think that has to go hand in hand with the focus on transparency and the importance of open data. There have to be the appropriate controls that reflect, that protect the integrity of research, which is what this is about. So I thought I'd just throw that one into the pot because I think it's a huge relief. And also I think is some evidence of how powerful universities can be when they act together, and there is a national campaign of that sort. It really can achieve impact. I would say that, though, wouldn't I, Universities UK, but I think it was a real success anyway, and I think it will enhance the way in which we can approach and the confidence we can have in approaching this issue of open access in terms of research.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We're 5 minutes into coffee time, which is a grievous failing on the chair's part, but hopefully it's all right. We've got 10 minutes, and the next session starts at 2:15 on the new digital paradigm. So just please put your hands together and give a nice round of applause for three top speakers. Thank you.